History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you're going to be disappointed if you don't hear, and you're never going to hear them unless you take a little time to listen to these stories from our veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve those stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know we're in for a good one today with 100-year-old Bill Gillette of San Jose, California. They called him G.I. Gillette when he was flying P-51s with the 4th Fighter Group in World War II. But we're going to start before that. Bill, take me back to Ottawa, Kansas. You're born the year that World War I ended, 1918. I'm sure you don't remember 1918 or 1919, but you probably remember the 20s. What was it like growing up on a farm in Ottawa, Kansas?
Well, I was born in the city, and my parents were pretty well educated. They both had high school educations and were teachers at their beginning when they were married. Then my granddad, I don't know how, made quite a bit of money in the farms, and he was a livestock breeder, beef cattle and stuff. And so my dad went to help him, so we moved from Kansas City to there. When I was born, we did not have a car. I like to say that my dad courted my mother in a horse and buggy and lived to see a man walk on the moon. Those kind of things are amazing. I was farming with horses. We plowed until in 1942. I started training, and in 2 years I'm flying a P-51 in war. So the transition, how fast, how naive, can I make it? I felt like I was just barely holding on by my fingertips, keeping up, which you don't know whether you keep it up. But the military training also was how long it took you to learn. I mean, you needed to solo a certain airplane, plus or minus something. And I found out later, because after World War II, Korea, then I was called back and was instructing pilots for Korean War and maybe into the Vietnamese War. And I never got qualified in a jet yet. I played golf with a guy who was in the same squadron, 334 Squadron, in Vietnam. A man from 334 Squadron came to my birthday party. There was a picture of the airplane. 334 Squadron is still flying. They were in Afghanistan. You know, he's flying a 1,400-mile-an-hour plane.
The P-51 wasn't going quite that fast. And I'm interested in hearing a little more about your childhood. I like the way you said that. You went from farming with horses to flying a P-51 in a couple of years. But as you're that boy growing up, what kind of jobs did you have to do on the farm? How hard was that work?
Well, you plow the land, you chop weeds with a hoe. So it was pretty primitive, but progress. John Deere just built a tractor. I remember that. And those kind of things. So in the late 30s, see, I was in high school. FDR was elected president, and the Hoover era moved into the Depression. But I was in high school in 1936, a senior in high school. My history teacher said, I'm going to make a prediction. You young boys or whatever, and we were all farm kids. It's a town of about 10,000, so farmers support the creameries and sell all their products and shop there and stuff. Anyway, the high school teacher said, before you young men graduate from college, the United States will be engaged in a world war. And all of you who are physically able will be in a military uniform, fighting for our way of life, which went right over my head at 17 years old.
So that's 5 years before the war, and he was that detailed in his prediction.
Yes. And after a war, I came home and went and found him and talked to him a little bit. He said the political in the Europe was just so identical to World War I from a history point that it just couldn't not happen.
Well, and before that, I'm sure there were some memorable times in that Depression era, because those of us alive today, we didn't live through that Great Depression. It doesn't seem like we can really fathom it. What are the things you remember about life in those days?
Well, you had food to eat. I can remember eating turnips all winter because good crop of turnips, but no potatoes and those kind of things. Struggling for food, the farm. If it rained, you could go plant some quick-growing crop, maybe, and salvage things. But it was a struggle for life. And ever being in Europe at that time would have been some crazy dream, I think I have. And 1942, I'm getting acquainted with the military, and absolutely, actually farming on a farm and working and living, I think, was harder than being in peacetime military training. You didn't get up till 6 o'clock in the morning or something, reveille. At 5 o'clock, it was all through. There was beer and everything. You got, $13 a month or something? And actually, you transition slowly, but was in that same boat, kind of. We had to struggle, we had to do things, and partly the war went that way because we innovated whatever we needed. And the P-51, after I started flying in Europe, went through several major changes and suffered some pretty severe things, and then resurrected and become a bigger airplane and a better airplane, and eventually changed the war. I never gotten an airplane until I was in the Army. It started in January 1942 in the military. You go through tests. One was what a Victrola is?
Yeah.
It looked like a Victrola, and on it was a little spot on that table, was a dime, and this thing turned around like a Victrola. They give you a little probe electronically, and you had to keep that probe on that dime spot as it went around. That's one of the tests. One of the tests was you sit down like this, and there's a stick, and there's two rows of lights. They turn a light on, and you have to find where this stick turns that light out. I can see that because the control, that's very like the stick control in the airplane. Anyway, those kind of things. At the time, what is this telling them? How does this tell them? I got on a ship, and I told one of my students later, when I graduated from flying school, my uncle came around and said, if you'd go to England, I had arranged a cruise over to England, and there'd be an airplane, and you could fly around and look at the sights in Europe and stuff like that. And, and I have no idea whether he ever learned that there wasn't any choice to the offer. You get on this boat and you go.
So the uncle you were talking about was Uncle Sam, and this wasn't an invitation. You had orders, and it definitely wasn't a sightseeing trip. Sounds like that went right over the heads of some of your students. I know you're a flight instructor for more than 30 years, but you also had to survive 59 combat missions with the 334th Fighter Squadron to do that. Were you at all prepared for what those combat conditions would be?
I had shot quail, those kind of things, but they never shot back at me. And when the second mission, I realized those little black spots are being shot at me on my second or third mission. My squadron commander was Mike Sabansky, a Polish young man, still Polish. In 1939, he sat and watched Hitler's troops march across Poland. This is 5 years later or so. He has gone to Canada, learned to fly, gone back to England, joined this non-British unit, and his squadron commander. And you think he didn't insist on my attitude being a little indignant at the Germans? I'm Greek, Steve Pisanos. A similar circumstance. The Germans did something, so he went to Canada. But he was in the 334 squadron, too. He later got shot down and joined the mafia or the escape evasion people. He says there's more action here than there is in the airplane.
We've had him on the program, the Flying Greek. He's no longer with us, but he had quite a story of surviving, bailing out of his P-51, jumping off the wing or something like that.
Yes, and his stories lived in the squadron. I mean, somebody could quote you, well, Steve did this or Steve in there. Jim Goodson, an American, he spoke French and German besides English, I think. But he was in England as a boy, and then got on a ship, started back to the United States. A German sub sunk his ship. He got on a lifeboat. The submarine surfaced and strafed the lifeboat, but they didn't get him. So he's come back to Canada, and he is one of these guys. And he had nothing in mind but getting even. So my attitude towards the Germans was changed drastically. There's a fourth guy that I used. All of these guys had been there a year or so before I got there. Some of them had fought in Dunkirk. And those kind of things. They flew Hurricanes and Spitfires. They talked English. We didn't talk English. It was a kite. It wasn't an airplane. It was a petrol bowser. The information was gin and those kind of things. And something accomplished was a piece of cake. And
so you had to learn a new language.
That's right. And I found out I couldn't fly near good enough to satisfy these guys. I got there on May the 1st. Don Blakesley was the first impressive person I met. We go through checking in the base in military person, and the colonel wants to see you. He's out on a mission now. So we go up in his office, which is on the second floor, and you look out over the field. And he said, here he comes. You know, here he comes an airplane, jacked up, a white scarf flying. He's a big man. When he opens the door, it doesn't really open. Leather jacket, this white scarf. We all get tattooed. The oxygen mask comes around here. We don't wear goggles. They're up here in case we need them because of 5G churn. But we had them in case of fire. So the goggles, sunglasses were put in a pocket before takeoff and stuff like that. And thought, wow. And he takes about 2 minutes to say, I'm Colonel Don. I'm the boss. He says, I'll see you at the bar tonight. Turn on his heel and slam the door. Now there's six or seven of us brand new pilots. Sit there and looked at each other. That was a welcome introduction to the way he ran the thing. I mean, our business was we didn't chit-chat. If you saw the radio chatter on Red Tails or something, no, that's for use, you know, tell somebody to break, but don't chit-chat. And that's the way. And we might get clear to the target area without a word saying after we started the airplanes. Don Blakesley flew every third mission, I think. And if he liked, wanted to be on this one, why then he might walk in and say, Jim, you're off the hook. I'm going to lead this mission and stuff. I mean, he got out there. He didn't say, you go do, you follow me, and I'll take you there. And the stories, I don't know if you've heard any stories. There's stories that he come back and said to the crew chief, I got two, give them to so-and-so. You know, he hasn't gotten any yet. And remember, I didn't fly this long because he's running into limit time. They have a certain amount of time when they suspect you're getting frazzled or whatever. And they claim that he had nearly twice as much combat time as records showed.
So he wanted to stay there and fly so much that he would fudge the amount of time he had been flying so he could stay longer.
Yes. And, I mean, these are stories. I never actually ever heard him say anybody. But people say these things. I came back and take an hour off my time or something. Like that. And so impressed I was, and I still was.
So was Dwight Eisenhower, who as Supreme Allied Commander awarded Don Blakesley the Distinguished Service Cross. He also earned 2 Silver Stars, 8 Distinguished Flying Crosses, and even the British version of the DFC in World War II, one of many legendary pilots from the 4th Fighter Group. And we have the privilege of visiting with another one of them today in Bill G.I. Gillette. More of his adventures in P-51 Mustangs when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say,
I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit GoArmy.com. To talk to a local Army career counselor, call 559-323-1099.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.